Welcome to the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next.
Welcome, and thank you all for joining us for this episode of the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. In this show, we cover a broad range of topics that both cater to CRE newcomers and industry leaders alike. I'm your host, Jessica LaRusso, Director of Sales, and today we are thrilled to sit down with Susan King of HED. Before we dive in, a little bit about our guest. Susan is a registered architect and a principal at HED, one of the country's oldest and most prominent architecture and engineering firms, with over 400 staff across the country with revenues in excess of $100 million. With 35 plus years of experience, Susan became the third woman principal at HED in 2007, and she oversees the firm's housing and community work across the Midwest, advocating for attainable housing and green market transformation of the building industry. She holds the FAIA designation, the American Institute of Architects' highest membership honor, bestowed on architects who have made significant contributions to the profession and society and exemplify architectural excellence. Only 3% of AIA members hold the FAIA distinction, and Susan was the 18th woman from Illinois to attain this recognition. She has received many awards for her work, including the University of Cincinnati's Alumni of the Year Award in 2018 and the Women in Sustainability Leadership Award from Green Building and Design Magazine in 2016, which placed her among an elite group of women to have received that award. Susan is also a past chair of the AIA Chicago Committee on the Environment and past president of Chicago Women in Architecture. Susan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're very happy to have you. So I know we just covered a lot about your background, but to kick things off, we'd love to briefly learn a little bit more about your career path and some lessons that you learned along the way. So maybe you can start with, where are you from and how did you first get your start in architecture?
Sure. Okay. So I grew up in Northeastern Ohio, but I've lived in Chicago in the city proper for more than half my life. So that often surprises people that I had a a rural upbringing. Architecture very early on. I think this happens to a lot of people. I was studying art as a child. I had a knack for it, talent, mm-hmm. I guess we would say. And in an art class in eighth grade, I studied Frank Lloyd Wright, and in particular, Falling Water. And after that, I was like, that's what I want to do. And so then when I applied to colleges, very different from today, I pretty much applied to one place, which was University of Cincinnati. My parents wanted me to stay within the state. And they have a really great program. So I graduated from there, and part of their program is actually a co-op program. So I started working in architectural offices after my second year.
Oh, wow.
And one of the jobs that I had during school was in Chicago. And so fell in love with the city and came here after I graduated and have worked here ever since. And then if you want me to continue, I'll talk a little bit about the pathway into housing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm also from the Chicagoland area originally, by the way.
So I worked in several different firms, both in college and then out of college. And I was actually at a smaller office, about 15, 20 people, when I became a licensed architect. And, you know, it was I actually thought I would be in a medium-sized firm. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I say surprised me was I also did think I would be an owner. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I would be a sole proprietor. I thought I would have partners, but I didn't realize I would have 50 partners, which is what I have now. But that aside, when I was with the smaller firm and at the point of which I, became a licensed architect, I got good experience there. Smaller projects, not housing at all. And it was during that time that I started to refocus. And I was actually, believe it or not, working on manufacturing facilities.
Wow.
And a lot of, I call it my other life. But this was, funny, but because it's true or whatever, all of my projects, none of them were in the city of Chicago, and I really wanted to work in the city. And that was not, I would say, if you had told me, when I was graduating from college, I would be working on 8 years out, whatever it was, I never would have believed you. But at any rate, it was a good experience, but it was also a point in my, a very intentional point to focus on what I actually really wanted to work on the rest of my life. So so that said, I did cast a pretty broad net. So housing was part of it, and not necessarily single family housing, but apartment buildings,
right.
city living. And but I also interviewed at places that did schools. I wanted to be more involved with things that I felt like, we're in the public realm a little bit more. So I got the position that I hold, not the same position, the firm that I'm with today to do housing. And that was actually, it was kind of hard to shift at that point because I'd sort of become an expert in manufacturing, which I was like, okay, how do I, it was hard to get somebody to sort of take a chance on me, to give me a new typology, new building typology to learn. So I actually, my first project when I came on board as now a project architect back then in the last century, was a large, actually, it was a large senior living independent facility in Calumet City. So just outside of Chicago, but still pretty much very urban, urban setting. So that was that project. It was pretty big. It was, I think I already said it was affordable. It was 181 apartments.
Wow.
On the independent line, end of the line, and it was kind of historic because it was funded by HUD, a HUD program, and it was the client was actually Catholic Charities, and they had brought two HUD funding applications together to make the 181. And so it was kind of, at the time, it was one of the largest projects that HUD had done in so many years. So
that's,
it was
quite a project to have your first taste in the housing side of things. Did you have mentor or manager that kind of helped you transition with the transition from manufacturing over there?
Sure. But it was also a lot, it felt a lot like people used the term drinking from a fire hose. It was a little bit like, or the fire hydrant, for that first year, and even really 2 years, because it was one thing to get the project out, out the door and permitted. It was another thing then to actually get it built.
I'm sure. So, how long did that project take?
I think there was a little gap from when there typically is in affordable housing, maybe in all projects, but especially in affordable housing, from when you finish and you issue for permit, you're kind of, the major work is done. You're waiting to start, get the permit and start construction. But the thing that's different from other types of housing is on the affordable side, there's a long period, we often call it the black hole, where we're not really sure what the client's doing stuff, but to get to their financial closing is really, really complicated. And sometimes there are things that are out of their control, but there's can be a gap. So removing that gap, I think, I feel like it was a 2.5-3 year project, but the construction was at least a year and a half.
Big project
of that.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing. What a fascinating and wonderful night. Can't believe at 10 years old, you already knew that's what you wanted to do. That's amazing.
Yeah. It is, but you hear that story a lot from architects. Like,
really?
Some take a more, not everyone, no one's the same, but I feel like there's a lot of people who will say that that's their, they knew it early on. And for me, not just for architect, I didn't realize till later that most people don't know a lot of, there's probably more people that don't know what they want to do, especially at a young age.
Right. Well, you're so. In the heart of it in Chicago, known for some of the most amazing architecture in the world. Love to move more into the present day, right? So that's how you got your start in the world of housing design. But to provide a little bit of context, can you explain HED, the work you're doing there today, and, you know, projects you're specializing in now?
Sure. So HED does a lot of things, and we are full service. We have engineering in addition to architecture, but we do have a pretty robust housing and mixed use, we call it now, sector. And so I'm a part of that. And, you know, I sit in our Chicago office, so I have seniority. So I lead that practice for the, you know, pretty much for the Midwest. We do have offices in Detroit. That's probably the other Midwestern office. Then we also have offices in a newer office in Dallas and Boston. And then we have a lot of California offices. And so we've grown over the years through really a series of acquisitions. And I guess I just mentioned that because, well, I keep saying we do healthcare, we do other things besides housing. And so, you know, our long-term goal as the practice is, of course, to be able to do all sectors everywhere. But right now, where we are at this point in time, I'd say the strongholds for housing are still in Chicago and our Los Angeles offices. So we've got a lot of, you know, work in those areas. So the types of work are all really broad, from students to seniors, really, and everybody in between. And that will include affordable housing, but also market rate. Well, and then me in particular, you know, my expertise goes way back to that first project. It's affordable, and senior living is still a big part of what we're doing and looking at.
Well, thank you. So, I mean, speaking of senior living, can you share with our listeners, what are some of the fundamentals of senior housing or older adult only housing that are important for anyone that's trying to invest or operate in the space to understand?
So senior living as a bucket all by itself is kind of complicated. So I guess I'll start at what the project I mentioned, independent living. So if you look at it on a spectrum or on a realm of care, and it has to do with levels of care. The continuum begins with independent. It's an age restricted facility, but there's no there might be services and programs and things for the seniors to do, but there's no medical care at that level. And then from there you graduate to as you grow older and daily living activities become more challenging, then assisted living would be the next step. And that is a regulated, so that's a big difference too. Like independent is not regulated by public health departments, but assisted living is. So that's a big distinction. And so it's just another layer, you know, of things, especially as an architect, that you have to pay attention to and address. So I'll try to keep it simple. Then you would have skilled nursing, which then starts to be more like a hospital-like setting. Then in between there, somewhere between assisted and skilled, is memory care, which is tough. And those facilities tend to be smaller in terms of beds, intentionally, because they want, it's almost like group living for people who can't, you know, have very serious short-term memory challenges. And it's also licensed. So it, I kind of describe it as in the middle of assisted and skilled, but it's probably more like skilled because it's a regulated facility. And then, so that's kind of like the traditional spread. And for a long time, a lot of developers or sponsors, if you want to call them that, on the not-for-profit organization side, they would call them life plan communities. That's what they call them today.
Okay.
They called them continuing care communities. So I think it was CCRC because retirement was was in there somewhere. And then they're constantly changing it, what they call it, or rebranding it. But it was probably a decade before it was CCRC, and then they decided they would call them life plan communities. But the idea would be you'd have a large site where you could provide the full continuum of care. Now, what's happened in the last, I don't know, probably 10 years is, and I think it's kind of exciting, but we all hear this population's growing, and it's growing not just because of the baby boomer situation, certainly that gave it a boost, but also because we're healthier, which is a really positive thing. Mm-hmm. We're just living longer and we're able to live longer independently. So that's all, you know, good news. But what I've seen emerge in terms of, now I'm kind of jumping ahead to a current trend, is this interesting typology called active adults, which I think is, I disagree with the name, but anyway, that's what they're calling it.
That's the new name right now.
They're the new name, but it's also interesting because it's not, they don't want to be called independent living and they don't want to be on the same campus with all of that continuing care. So it's a whole shift away from, I landed here and now this is it. I'm staying here and I've got all the care I need in the future right here at this community. So whatever, call it whatever you want. Maybe they're in denial. I don't know.
But they're not accessing that care yet necessarily.
They don't. Yeah. So these tend to be standalone buildings that don't have the amenity rich stuff that the life plan communities might have. And so, yeah. So it's fascinating.
So that's where you're seeing things kind of move over toward like more services on site or.
Yeah. Well, I tend to, I don't have a good example of a life of an, I'd have to look up something because we actually haven't gotten an active adult project yet.
Okay.
I want to get one, but what, so I don't have a good, well, I don't have an HED example and I can't think of one right now from somewhere else, but maybe you can fill that in later.
Sure.
Or I can try and find one, find a cool one, because what I'm seeing for the examples that I like that are completed or underway, mm-hmm. they tend to actually be more urban setting. So downside is land might cost more because it's in a city mm-hmm. already, but the upside is they're not expecting, these buildings don't have meal programs, for example. So you're not, so that would drive your, you know, you're not doing a full blown kitchen. You're
right.
not doing a lot of real estate to a big dining room because the active adult wants to be in a setting where they can walk, you know, walkability, they can walk down the street to the restaurant, you know, the neighborhood restaurant. So the site is located in a place where there's walkability, which I think is,
that's really
cool.
Interesting. Absolutely.
That's where I would want to live
yeah.
as a senior.
They have
you know,
more so. Access to amenities and can go off site and not necessarily feel like, you know, they're stuck on a site that's kind of far away from the city or from
everything
know, loved
else.
Ones, everything
exactly.
else. Very interesting.
Right.
So what does the current project interest landscape look like for these spaces? Where do you see most stakeholder interest coming from that's driving these new developments? I know you mentioned you're hoping to get one of these as well.
Yeah. It does seem to be like it's coming from the market rate developers are, you know, trying to capture that typology. Mm-hmm. I don't see it as much in the not-for-profit mission-based. Though the not-for-profit mission group, and that doesn't necessarily mean affordable, but a lot of them are already, you know, they're kind of, they've been doing it a long time. They're in the life plan community business because they already have a campus. So I'm not mm-hmm. seeing them, and no one, and I guess it's too different. It's kind of maybe causing a little bit of a division. Right. Because of what I said earlier, the people who want to live in these places don't want that life plan community model. So and the people running the life plan community are just trying to keep. And, you know, but another part of it is not to say that the life plan community people are going to go whatever out of business or under or anything like that. I think it's just about choices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like people just one thing, one size doesn't fit all. Not everyone wants to be in the. You know, I put my roots down here and this is it. I'm done. They want the option to have this other thing as long as they can.
Thank you for elaborating on that. So maybe looking at like the life plan community sector, maybe some of the projects that you're working on, right? What do the housing facilities generally look like? What are some exciting things that, you know, you might be doing at your firm to change some of those norms? Anything with like sustainability as an example?
Yes. Yeah, I can talk a lot about sustainability, but I guess before I jump into that, though, I will talk. I wouldn't call it a life plan community, but we have a really nice project that's starting construction with a mission-driven group called the Danish Home, and they've been here in Chicago in the Norwood Park neighborhood, so it's the kind of northwest side, for over 100 years. It might be 125, like a really long time. And it's they, you know, they used when we met them, because we did master planning with them and all of that. It's really unique. It's a unique place. I feel like it's kind of a secret, or that's what I always tell them when I go there. So they've had this campus for a long time, but they call it boutique. And it's partly boutique because of, I guess, two reasons. One, the size. I think when we started with them, they're around 40-ish, 40 to 50. Yeah, it's
On the smaller
small.
side.
But they were trying to figure out what the future held for them. But the other thing is, unlike some of these older groups, they've held on to this Danish culture thing that defines them. Not to say you have to be Danish to live there, but the food is Danish. It's like, I mean, it's a special, it's a really, I'm excited. I'm so glad they're fine. But they had to do a capital campaign to raise all their money to build. So they're doing an addition. So we helped them with master planning. The master planning is larger than this first phase. But they're at the end of the day, so they are taking really old rooms that had two people in them, so what they call semi-private in the skilled nursing world, and deconverting, those rooms to so that only one person will be using those rooms, and then adding rooms. But at the end of the day, because of the deconversion, it only ends up being, I don't know, it's like 5 to 10. We're really not adding that many people, so it's more like depopulating it. And then they have a pretty large space at the ground garden level, because it's an existing condition situation. But we're building a pretty large gathering. It will serve it's a multifunction space,
It's
but it
amazing.
will be their dining room every day. But also they have these amazing community events that right now, because they have an amazing yard, which they're still going to have, because I'm like, we can't screw this up.
Right, you need to keep the outdoor space.
Right? Yes, beautiful garden where now when they have their they have a summer solstice event. It parallels like the
Incredible.
Danish. And then they're having a fall fest in a couple weeks. But anyway, usually they put up tents and everything. So now this will allow them to have, an interior space that opens out to that garden, and it's going to be really nice. It's small, but it's going to be a good project when it gets done. So
That's incredible.
what does that tell you? I'm not sure, but on the sustainability side. So what I was going to talk a what always comes first to me for sustainability in seniors, especially coming out of COVID, is air quality and ventilation. And so again, that's not something fancy that you can see, but it's really, really important. And I hate to say we got anything good out of COVID, but I think in the sustainability world, people were really pushing for a long time for good ventilation and air quality, and on all, not just with senior living, but maybe even a heightened importance there, because that's our frailest, most heavily hit by COVID population, even today, right? It's still pretty scary. So, at any rate, I think that if I have to say something good came out of COVID, that's one of people, everyone gets that now. And so I think we're getting better
That's
air
great.
in all of our buildings across sectors. And then biophilia. So again, pre-COVID, and you might still say it, maybe it's sometimes it's a corny thing or it's an obvious thing, but I think, especially in Chicago where we have winter and balconies are sometimes hard to sell here because whatever, you can only use them 4 months of the year or whatever it is. I think biophilia now, people really understand that as well, that it's not just this corny thing, that it's really emerged, like people get it, having been through the shutdowns and the value of the outdoor space, whether it's your little tiny balcony or it's a communal, garden of some kind. I think people are willing to pay for that now, and developers, everybody gets that. So I think those are two key things.
That's wonderful. So the newer developments, you're seeing more access to outdoor space for maybe some of the existing, you know, existing developments that might not have that. Are you seeing a lot of people going in and retrofitting these, or, you know, trying to add on more outdoor access?
That's an interesting question. So, you know, in the case I just spoke about with Danish, it's an existing campus that already had that garden. And so our thing is like, don't screw it.
Right.
Don't screw it up, which we would have felt that way anyway. Right. Because it is actually pretty amazing. So I can't say, I have another project. It's not senior related. And it's a longer, I'd be grasping if I said that was why. I think there were more complications as to why they're going to also have a larger green space. But I think that was sort of happening pre-COVID. But I think it makes it easier, when cost, whatever, there's always a budget. Mm-hmm. It's always tight. You know, I think there's more value being able to keep those things in the projects and also add them if you have space, I guess, right? Or see maybe the green space is already there, but it wasn't really programmed right. And some of these things aren't really construction cost oriented, right? It's how you run the building and run things later too, to activate the outdoor spaces.
That's great. Well, I'm glad to hear that that's trending in such a positive direction. So especially in a sector where affordable housing, you know, it's such a huge priority for most metros, right? Where does senior living facilities, where do they fit into the landscape? Where are there opportunities out there for investors, you know, looking to be in this space?
Oh, senior living. Yeah. It seems like it's there, and it just has to be land, right? Mm-hmm. The land needs to be available. Like when I talked about the active adult things, I think the developers that are looking at it would love to be, you know, in the heart of Chicago, but the land cost just kind of, unfortunately, doesn't make it pencil, you know? So it's probably a little bit out of range, but near enough again that hopefully it can be either on the metro. If talking about Chicago, you know, maybe it's transit oriented. So at least there's opportunity along the metro stop. So now you're getting a little bit out of the downtown area a little bit, and they might find more affordable land that way. But trying to find that balance, though, making it not too far out that, again, it's seniors, that they can walk to things and they can walk to the train. We actually had another project an older project in that same Norwood Park neighborhood as the Danish home. That's called Norwood Crossing, I think. And it's actually really near. It was way ahead of its time because it's really near a metro stop.
Oh,
but
wow.
It was also it was associated with a campus that had also been there a long time, and it was added on to. So I guess I would say, look at your mass transit. Mm-hmm. If I were a developer trying to find land, that might be a really good way to go about it. If you're assuming you're priced out of whatever's considered the downtown area of where you're looking, and then on the affordability side, you know, I'm assuming you mean not the government funded affordability or both.
Oh, we could talk about both. I think it'd be helpful for our listeners to kind of understand the difference in your thoughts.
So on the affordable side, that project I mentioned in the beginning, my first affordable housing project, it's kind of sad. We did a lot of work under that government program called HUD 202. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's not a funded program anymore. And it didn't, my understanding of it, is that it was kind of an accident that it became unfunded. And this goes way back to Obama, under Obama. And I guess they were focusing on other things, and it slipped 1 year, and then I'm oversimplifying the situation, but it was like, in terms of the budget, it was not funded 1 year, and everyone thought, don't worry, we'll get it back. Well, it never came back. And I want to say this was 2012, 2013. So that's, is sad, because at least my understanding now, I think you did have to be a not-for-profit mm-hmm. to take advantage of that, but I think you could also partner with a group to, if you were for profit, mm-hmm. I think there might have been some way around that. So that is a big missing chunk that never got replaced. And so now today, the affordable projects have to compete. So affordable senior, at least in Illinois, kind of has to compete, or probably across the country, with the other affordable housing projects for the same low-income housing tax credit dollars. Okay. So it's really, there's not like, some years it depends state by state, and each QAP kind of focuses on different things. I think sometimes over time, sometimes there's extra points if you're doing senior, but mm-hmm. it's not a dedicated program.
Wow.
So it's I think it's a gap that needs to be filled. Yeah, and then, you know, of course, but then I will always be the first one to say, overall, there's not enough money in our federal budget mm-hmm. for the housing crisis that we're looking at, not just for senior, but for everybody. And then in Illinois, and then I think Indiana has a similar program for, in Illinois, it's called the SLF, Supportive Living Facility mm-hmm. Program. And that was a program that provided operation subsidies for affordable assisted living, which is another huge need. Mm-hmm. Again, in Illinois, hugely successful program, totally oversubscribed, and it's licensed. So you need the subsidy and mm-hmm. the license all to work together. And it doesn't, I don't even know the last time they would open the program, and everybody would have been waiting for years and years, and it would be immediately like oversubscribed.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, so there's great models out there, but there needs to be money mm-hmm. to fund the programs, you know. And then I said, I think Indiana has a similar one. Theirs, I think, is called Residential Care Facility, RCF. And so we've had projects in both of those, but nothing going on right now because there's no operating subsidy. I mean, that's what you start. So the developer would apply for the operational mm-hmm. Piece. They would get that. Then they still had to go for the tax credits
wow.
for the construction part. Really complicated.
It's very, yeah. very complicated. And thank you for kind of explaining the difference, obviously, between the two sectors. And you mentioned funding, right? You know, in your opinion, how are these assets being affected? You know, what are you seeing in terms, you know, current macroeconomic factors? Like, what are you seeing affect this asset class the most, maybe outside of funding?
Yeah, right. Because, yeah, the funding will do its cycles and whatever. But mm-hmm. right now like I mentioned, you know, we're keen to get an active adult project going. And we've, you know, done studies and all of this. But it, same thing, I think, that's affecting all housing. It's the inflation. Everybody's very nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And so things are taking longer, being put on hold, all of that. So I think that's the biggest thing that's unfortunately slowing us down.
Okay. So inflation is number one. What is your...
Everybody's nervous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense. I mean, what is your, let's say your 2024, like short-term outlook for the sector, and then maybe your longer-term outlook for the sector?
Yeah, short term. I guess we're optimistic. We're still hoping we'll get some new market rate things going. But for me, the affordable piece seems relatively solid mm-hmm. for the next year. I mean, I have things under construction, obviously, that will finish in 2024. I'm kind of focused right now on trying to build my, what I call my 9% pipeline for next year. Our applications with the state applications are due the beginning of the year. So I need to be doing those, working with developers right now mm-hmm. On those studies, those feasibility, like they've got land, how many, you know, that whole exercise of like, how many units can we get? What size are they and all of that. So anybody out there who's needs help, give me a call because I'm trying to build that pipeline, because that's the thing. You have to have like 3 to 5 things applying
right
in order to get, you know, you may only get one funded. So, So yeah, I'm trying to build that up right now. That's on the affordable side. And then similarly, we're looking as a national practice at our kind of our national clients that we're studying them. You know, think most of them, you know, they're national, but they work regionally, and we're trying to we kind of work that way too, and we think that's a plus that we work like our clients do.
That's great.
So anyway, but we're still hopeful for them that they can get these things to pencil or just be brave and not be afraid of inflation.
Right.
I don't know what
well,
combination.
Well, kind of piggybacking off of that, what would you say is the most significant change you've noticed in this space, and what's going to have the most lasting impact in 2024? Is it inflation, or what have you seen
slowing us down? I hate to think we're going to have a slow year because of inflation, but or at least a slower year in the market rate, and that the affordable housing is going to just kind of keep moving along at its pace, which everyone will say isn't fast enough.
The demand is increasing year over year.
It's
though,
there,
right?
It's there. We just need the financing to get in line, or, you know, one way or another, whether it's the budget that we can't seem to pass, and, you know, more should be going to the housing from the federal government, or we need more creative ways of doing things too. And I don't know that there's so much going on right now in the world, right? You know, as we're speaking, there's so much distraction from this that well, who knows? Maybe something really creative that I'm not even thinking about will happen in 2024. It could happen.
Very possible. Oh, thank you for that. And, you know, given your specialized background and your expertise in this industry, I'm sure our listeners are really curious about some of your answers to a few rapid fire questions. Can I ask you a couple?
Okay, sure.
All right. We'll start with, if you were given $50 million today and had to start working on an architectural process immediately, what's your ideal project and why?
Okay. So project, not process, right?
Yes. Yeah. Project.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, $50 million is a lot of money. It's kind of hard. I know you're probably expecting me to say housing, but, yeah, maybe. Well, okay. I'll say two totally unrelated things if I can.
Two answers, of course.
Okay, I'll do housing first, and then we'll throw you for a little loop. So I think I don't know how far it would go, but you know, there's so much talk about $50 million is probably not enough, but prefab and modular, and it's been tried and failed, especially in Chicago over the years, and people have invested a lot of money in that. But it does seem like there's an answer there, and I don't know why we can't get it to scale. And there was a group in Seattle that did a pretty substantial high-rise building that I think opened during COVID, and I'm forgetting the name of it. And it wasn't senior-related. It was market rate. And it's right in downtown Seattle, and so maybe we cut out and I can, what later on you can paste in the name or whatever when you edit this, because I can track it down. Cause I was following it for a while, and I assume it did finally open, and it was super green. It was modular and it was super green. And so I was rooting for them to be successful. So I'm, you know, and it, for a while I was talking, I'm like, you guys should come to Chicago and all of that. So I would maybe invest in them if they're still out there and doing things.
I love
things,
that.
You know, because why reinvent the wheel?
Right.
You know, I mean, so that's one. And then on the other side, like just in terms of dream project, this will throw you for a loop. But I would love to do like, I always said my dream project was a net zero energy cat shelter.
Oh, I'm such a cat lover myself. So I love that.
Yes, I'm a big cat lover. And that does tie back. So yes, while I seem pretty clear in my direction to be an architect, prior to wanting to be an architect, I thought I wanted to be a veterinarian.
Oh, wow.
But the funny thing about that was that then I heard that I had to go to school for 8 years to become a veterinarian. And I was like, screw that. That's too long. But then I ended up going for six. to be an architect, so I don't know.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, I mean, what? There's the Anti-Cruelty Society right there downtown. I don't know how sustainable they are,
There
but maybe
is.
there's some partnership to be had.
Yeah. Well, there's actually another. There is a cat shelter here that claims to be net zero. I don't know if it really is or not, but and that's what it's called Harmony
Oh,
House. And I think that's where I got in my head. I was like, why did I not get called about doing
I
that
love that.
project?
That's so creative. Thank you for sharing.
So,
And
sure.
so kind of on that note, right? Where do you find most inspiration for your projects? Could be anything, anyone.
Wow, that is a hard question. I guess I was for many years our national sustainable design leader for the firm, and because of that, I went to Green Build many, many years, the Living Future, their unconference. So I always got a lot of inspiration from my colleagues and seeing what they were doing, touring, building. So, being able to take lessons from other buildings that are built and bring them back into housing, because a lot of times the really super green buildings aren't housing. So I think that it's, over the years, really from my peers, and looking at their work and being inspired by that to think, well, they could do it. We can do it too.
I love that.
So.
Okay, last rapid fire question. What is the most common misconception about your job or industry?
I think that good design costs more.
That's a really good
It
one.
doesn't have to cost more, and I consider sustainability to be part of good design. And we fight, we still fight that battle that the minute somebody says green, everyone thinks that means dollars.
Dollar
It's like,
signs, right.
no, it shouldn't be that way. So
That's a
it
real.
doesn't have to be that way. But it also depends on what your baseline is. If you want the lowest common denominator, if you want the cheapest thing on the shelf, then yeah,
Right.
the better thing might cost a penny more.
That's really good feedback. Thank you. So, as we wrap up, are there any parting words that you'd like to share with our audience?
Not that I can think of, other than apart, repeating what I already
No
said.
problem.
Looking for work, looking for
Good. Well,
call me.
we're about to let everybody know how they can get a hold of you.
That's right.
Yeah,
Right.
we really appreciate you joining and sharing your insights, of course. So, where can people find you online if they want to get in touch?
So I am on LinkedIn, so you can find me there easily. And then also HED.design is our website.
Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexy.com/podcast and sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexy Podcast on your favorite podcast app or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/crexy for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, and we'll see you next time.